Hey everybody, and welcome to Jesus at 2 a.m. I'm Kirk Winslow, and this is episode 7 of the podcast, part 2 of our series, Next Steps into Church History, our look at Protestantism from the Reformation to the present, or at least pretty close to the present. In this episode, we survey the early Protestant denominations, Lutherans, Presbyterians, Anglicans, and those known as the Radical Reformers. We'll explain who they were, where they were, and what distinguished them from one another, and then we'll concentrate in some detail on those in England who came to be known as the Puritans. It was their conflicts with the Church of England that would eventually lead a few to board a ship called the Mayflower and head for the New World. So if you aren't sure what distinguishes an Anglican from a Lutheran, a Presbyterian from a Baptist, or if you've always wanted to know more about those pilgrims who came to Plymouth in 1620 and how their influence is felt even today, then this is the episode for you. As always, thank you for the nice email. Several of you have sent in some great topic suggestions for future episodes. I take those very much to heart. And a special shout out to Eric and Corey for the very nice reviews on iTunes. I really, really appreciate those. If you want to get in touch now or ever, you can send an email to mail@jesusat2am.com or go to the website, jesusat2am.com, and you'll see a contact link there. If you find yourself in Orange County on some Sunday morning, please come say hi at Irvine Presbyterian Church. It'd be great to meet you in person. And the next episode is coming to you soon, I promise. I've been working on a big project, which I will tell you more about shortly. But for now, thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to week 2, Next Steps into Church History. And before we move into the 17th century this week, I thought it would be helpful to take just a minute to sketch out a little bit our family tree. One of the questions that many people have about Protestant churches is what defines the various denominations. People are in our age somewhat confused about what is a Presbyterian versus a Lutheran, versus a Methodist, versus a Baptist, versus the non-denominational, none of the above. So I thought, since we now have the ability to start answering that question based on our last conversation, I thought we'd sketch it out just a little bit and remind you, we won't cover it again, but from 30 AD, the day of Pentecost, to 1054 AD, we have one church, the church. In 1054, the tensions between the Eastern and the Western branches of the church finally reached their breaking point, and we have what's known as the Great Schism. And the Eastern Church, rooted in Constantinople, goes its own way, claims the title Orthodox. They become the Eastern Orthodox Church. The church centered in Rome, Western Europe, goes its own direction and comes to be known the Roman Catholic Church. And it's from that branch that our Protestant tradition comes, from the Roman Catholic branch. Roman Catholicism continues on as a fairly monolithic thing for the next 500 years or so, and then splits again somewhere in the 1520s-ish. You know, Luther's 95 Theses were 1517, his excommunications 1521. By 1522, you have Ulrich Zwingli, essentially in charge of the church in Zurich. 1534, you have the official founding of the Church of England. So all that's happening at the same time. And when the formal split between the Roman Church and this new Protestant thing happens, the Protestants didn't coalesce into a singular movement, but rather splintered into a whole variety of strains right at the very beginning. So I didn't diagram this as beautifully as somebody with more skill than I could have, but this is all happening fairly simultaneously in those third and fourth decades of the 16th century. One of those splinter groups, quite predictably then, is Lutheranism. Right? As we know, there were many in Western Europe who shared Luther's distress even before Luther officially ended up as the pioneer of that movement. So when Luther was excommunicated, he didn't go then into hiding, as others who had been excommunicated before him would have had to. By this point, Luther's got enough popular momentum based on the average upset of the people, that he doesn't have to go into hiding. But along with his partner, Philip Melanchthon, he led a movement that formed congregations and then pulled them together in worship and study, and effectively creates a Lutheran church. Luther didn't set out to create Lutheranism. He set out to purify Roman Catholicism. But when Roman Catholicism boots him out, he does not then leave those who have rallied behind him to fend for themselves. He feels obligated to be the shepherd to his sheep, and sort of by default, a Lutheran church is born. I mean, Luther is a man of great conviction and passion, and so once he gets a head of steam going in a direction, he's going to follow it through. And so he begins to write letters and sermons, ensures the Bible is translated into German so that the German people who wish to follow his understanding of a purer church have a place to go. So Lutheranism is effectively born and was particularly influential, not surprisingly, in Germany and also in the Scandinavian countries of Norway, Finland, and Sweden. So Lutheranism takes shape on the European continent, particularly in Germany and Scandinavia. Simultaneously, in places like Zurich and Geneva, the other strains of Protestantism, or at least another strain of Protestantism, is taking shape, what we will later refer to as the Reformed tradition or the Reformed Church. And just make a note of the capital R. So there's the Reformation, which is broad, and then there's the Reformed Church, which is a subsection of the Reformation. The Reformed tradition traces its origins to Zwingli and Calvin. So the Reformed Church and the Calvinist Church are essentially the same thing. But you'll often hear it referred to as the Reformed Faith or the Reformed Church, capital R. That's the Calvinist strain. They share much in common with each other, Calvin and Zwingli. Also, the Reformed tradition and the Lutheran tradition share much in common with one another. Zwingli and Luther were actually brought together in 1529 by their respective handlers, the people who were the feet on the ground. People finally realized that Lutheranism and, at that time, Zwinglianism were developing very similar courses but diverging, and the thought was that maybe we could get this Protestant movement to be a singular entity right at the get-go. So in 1529 in Marburg, Germany, Zwingli and Luther were brought together. And of the 15 points for debate, they agreed on 14 of them. Wow. But they could not agree on the 15th, which had to do with the presence of Christ in the Lord's Supper. There's actually a famous story of the two of them gathered together. Luther retained the Roman Catholic idea of Jesus' body being in some way physically present in the sacrament. You know, Roman Catholicism believes that when the priest says the words of the Mass, that the bread and the cup become literally the body and blood of Jesus. Luther couldn't quite go that far, but he didn't want to lose it altogether, and so he came up with sort of this middle idea where the body, the actual physical body and blood of Jesus are physically woven into the elements. The elements aren't converted entirely. You know, there's still wine and bread there, but the body and blood of Jesus are physically present. Zwingli just couldn't agree to that. So the two of them end up in a big debate about this. The legend is that Luther got out his pocket knife and he carved into the debate table, "Hoc est corpus meum," this is my body. And that whenever Zwingli would try to persuade him out of that idea, Luther would just tap at the word est, carved into the table. This is my body. This is my body. And of course, Zwingli retorted that Jesus also said, "Well, I am the sheep gate. Do you believe that Jesus is a gate?" And the two of them could not come together. And so the Protestant movement did not coalesce in its very beginnings, but different branches begin to emerge. In 1534, we have Henry VIII, we know, establishing the Church of England, which is a very different animal than the Lutheran strain or the Reformed strain. Both of them, Luther and Zwingli and later Calvin, are separated on theological ground, and in particular, the sacramental ground. The Church of England is its own Reform or its own Protestant strain, But it's not separated so much on theological ground, but on political ground. Right? Henry VIII wants a divorce. That's how we end up with this other branch of the Protestant tradition. It is a church almost in search of a theology, but it has a very clear institutional structure. And so the struggle within the Church of England is going to be, what do we fill it with? We now have a hierarchy, we have buildings, we have clergy. Now what do we do? What do we have them do? What do they believe? And how much can we mandate that? How much can the government affect those decisions? The Church of England was organized mainly around the Book of Common Prayer. So less about biblical interpretation and more about the unity of our prayer book, our worship service. Whatever church you go to in England, you're going to participate in the same prayer book. So that obviously is shaped by a particular theology. The prayers you say are affected by your theology, but that's different than a group of people organized around a confession of faith. And then there's a whole other series of groups that are often given the umbrella title of the Radical Reformers, and we're going to talk more about them a little bit later in this lecture. But for today, we're mainly going to focus on the relationship between the Reformed tradition and the Church in England, as there is a direct connection to the foundation of our nation and our religious culture here in America. Our connection is with the Church in England and the Reformed tradition as those come together. So we're going to go back for a moment to look again at the reign of King Edward VI, son of Henry VIII, who comes to the throne upon Henry's death. And you'll recall from last week that Edward is forced into Protestantism. And the reformers in England take that as an opportunity to establish as much of a cultural foothold as possible, right? Edward had to be a Protestant because his claim to the throne as a legitimate heir of Henry VIII is only if Henry's divorce is legit. So Edward VI has to be a Protestant. But once he has to be a Protestant, all the Protestants in England think now's the time. Now's the time to secure a cultural foothold while the king has to support us. So let's get as much Protestantism, as much Protestant culture rooted into England as quickly as possible. And so the first thing they do is they create that Book of Common Prayer, which prescribes the ordering of Sunday liturgy, as well as daily prayer and the lectionary for all of England. When Edward dies, not long after coming to the throne, he's succeeded, remember, by Mary Tudor, Bloody Mary, and the first thing that she does is throw out the Book of Common Prayer and return as quickly as she can to the Roman Catholic Mass. Protestant liturgy out, Roman liturgy back in. All the churches in England are now going to use the Catholic Mass book and the Catholic Prayer book, and we're going to say the Catholic prayers and do the Catholic Mass and so on. And she goes on a campaign of purging Protestants and their traditions, and establishing Catholics, again, in positions of cultural and political power. When she dies, Elizabeth I comes to the throne. And things are at this point ripe for war. Right? Elizabeth, just like Edward, is forced to be a Protestant. She probably is a Protestant by leanings anyway, but she's forced to be a Protestant. But she has Catholics now in power all over the country. You know, one option, she could do a Mary Tudor-style purge. She could have all of them killed or thrown out of the country, burn all their mass books. But that just sets her up for civil war eventually. And she's certainly seen that break out in plenty of other places. Furthermore, sitting on the throne in Scotland is Mary Stuart, who is a Catholic, who wants Elizabeth's throne. So if Elizabeth goes on too much of a purge of Roman Catholicism, Mary Stuart in Scotland is probably going to rally a lot of Roman Catholics to her side to basically make sure that one day Elizabeth just doesn't wake up. I mean, that's how these things work. At the end of the day, she is going to get her throat cut. And so in a tense and complex political situation, Elizabeth has got to come up with a solution. If she plays her cards right, I mean, if Elizabeth can pull it off, she can stabilize the church and the state. She can win a ton of popular support, and she can probably dramatically increase her life expectancy. But she does not have a great hand, and if she misplays her cards, she is gonna wake up with her throat cut. So What is her next move? And Elizabeth's solution is brilliant. She proposes what she calls the Via Media, Latin for the middle way. She says the Church of England will be a compromise, which is the kind of thing you can imagine in England. I mean, you know, the cultural norms make a tremendous impact on what can work and what doesn't. So you propose to a group of Brits that a reasonable compromise should work. You might actually be able to pull that off in England in a way that you might not even pull it off in Scotland. So she proposes the middle way. And she's going to try to grant each of these two groups what matters most to them. So what matters most to the Catholics is liturgy and sacrament and office. Right? They want a church that feels traditionally Roman. There's Roman ceremony, Roman flavor. So that's what Roman Catholics get out of the deal. They're going to get a church that looks and acts Roman Catholic. What matters to the Protestants in England is much more the content of the church. They're not as concerned about the shape of the buildings or whether the priest wears a this kind of hat or a that kind of hat. What they want is teaching that sounds Reformed. Generally, Calvin has a tremendous influence in Britain, and so they want a Reformed-sounding church that's going to preach Calvinist theology, going to teach a Calvinist perspective on the Bible. And that Protestant understanding of piety, what it means to live out your faith in day-to-day practice, the kind of life that God desires for his people. And so this is essentially Elizabeth's Via Media. We're going to get a Church of England that looks Catholic. Catholic cathedrals, cool robes, fancy hats, lots of pomp and ceremony. But the content of the liturgy that happens in that space will be Protestant and will have some very Calvinist leanings. And what Elizabeth gets out of this deal for herself is not only greatly reducing the idea of civil war, which makes her very happy, but also as an added bonus, she gets a church that is governed by bishops. The Roman Catholic hierarchy, that Roman Catholic structure, she preserves. Because even though monarchs don't like being beholden to bishops, they like it better than the idea that bishops are unnecessary. And so monarchs never like having to be subservient to anybody or having to take other people particularly into account. But better you should have a church with bishops you have to work with than to have a church structure in which bishops are right out. Because once the bishops go, who goes next? Monarchs. So Elizabeth has issued a new Book of Common Prayer for the Church of England, and off we go. And now the Church of England is here to stay, and it will continue on into today. And as it expands beyond the land of Britain itself, it will become known as the Anglican Church, like the Church of England that will eventually become the worldwide Anglican communion that we know today, of which the Episcopal Church in America is a direct descendant. So if you have any friends who are Episcopal, they are members of the Anglican Communion, the Church of England, and still share a common Book of Common Prayer. All right, so this satisfies a fair number of people in England. The vast majority of the English are willing to go along with this middle way, but there are some who are not so enthused. And one group that is not very enthused is the Presbyterians. You'll recall that the Presbyterians trace themselves through Knox not only to Calvinist theology, but to the structure of church government in Geneva, a church ruled by a council and not by a priest or a bishop. You remember in last week's lecture, we talked about the three forces that came together to shape Protestantism, or to give the Protestant movement that momentum it needed to finally expand. One was leaders within the Roman Catholic Church calling for reform. One was tensions between the monarchs and the powers, the bishops and the powers of the Roman Church. And third was the rise of a middle class that wanted more autonomy. And the more time passes, the more that third factor becomes so important, the rise of a middle class that wants autonomy. More and more, people don't want a monarch. They want increasing measures of self-determination. And in a Presbyterian ecclesiastical structure, they get it. Right, so you go to church on Sunday and suddenly you come to an institution that is governed not by a monarch, but by a council, a group of people who are responsible for how our corporate life will be shaped. And so you can imagine that the Presbyterianism gains great popular support from its governmental structure. People already kind of share the Reformed theology, but you can have Reformed theology and be in the Church of England, no problem. But if you also want some measure of self-determination, suddenly the Presbyterian view of governing things gains tremendous appeal. And you can imagine that many members of the English Parliament will come to have strong Presbyterian leanings. Because if you're a member of Parliament, you kind of agree that monarchs should have as little power as possible. So the Presbyterians and the Parliament, the House of Commons, will come to have tremendous connection with one another. And we won't go into the details here, but eventually it's out of that relationship that the Westminster Confession of Faith will be born, and then the Westminster Catechisms that are so foundational to us arise out of the English Parliament wanting some theological, official theological understanding from which to work. And that's how the Westminster Divines come together to shape those great documents. So there are Presbyterians who are not thrilled with the Via Media. But there are others who don't love it, who gather under the title of Puritan. And that is a very generic term. By Puritan, what they meant was they wanted a church purified of Catholic influence. That was the pure they were after. The Puritans felt that the Roman Church had departed so severely from the biblical faith that retaining any vestiges of Catholicism was simply unacceptable. You just had to throw the whole thing out. And thus, they were not going to go quietly into the Church of England. And here's where things get immediately complicated, because one cannot really speak of Puritanism. You can really only speak of Puritanisms. There were many different strains of Puritanism. And here's one of the vexing problems for Protestantism from this point forward. It's all well and good to say that the ultimate authority in the church resides not in bishops and not in tradition, but in the Bible. Right? It's the Bible that will become the final authority that governs matters of life and faith. But that claim suggests that the Bible is an easily understood field guide to the Christian life that requires little interpretation and is equally applicable to people in every time and place and culture. And we know that that is very much not true. And so we have a group of people insisting on a church grounded in the Scripture, and yet they themselves quickly come to division about what it is the Scripture cares most about. And so if Puritans would say we cannot be part of the Church of England because the Church of England has some Catholic stuff, and Catholic stuff means there's authority given to bishops and tradition, and we want a church grounded only in the Bible. Okay, a church grounded only in the Bible, what does that mean? So, will we have a prayer book at all? What kind of prayer book? Like, does a church grounded in the Bible, is that also a church with a prayer book, or is that a church without a prayer book? Which is more biblical, scripted prayers or not scripted prayers? Should we have prayers that are rooted in the Psalms or prayers that are led by the Spirit? Do we believe in priests? Well, if you're Puritan, probably not. Do you believe in pastors? Elders? What kind of church authority is biblical church authority? Do we have an altar? Do we have a communion table? Should we have any adornment at all within our worship space? Who can take part in communion? How repentant do you have to be? If we know you to be kind of a sinner, can you still come to the table? If you're still pretty much, how pious should one be a part of the communion table? How pious does your life need to be a member of the church? Is membership something that is easily granted, or is that something that you have to work very hard to prove yourself to be worthy of membership? What constitutes piety anyway? Like, what are the moral things that God cares most about? How you dress? How you act? How you do business? Who is a member of your family? Who's your next door neighbor? Who you eat with? Who you don't eat with? Suddenly you can imagine, once you say you're going to have a biblical church, are you going to have a church? Or are you going to have a lot of little congregations, each of which fragment themselves? So once you determine that you're going to be biblical, it's very easy to end up tremendously divided. Because anybody who doesn't interpret the Bible as you do, or prioritize the biblical ideals as you do, might be undermining the one true faith that you are so concerned to preserve. So how like us does someone need to still be an us? And at what point do they become a them? And now within the church, we have us and them. And so if you can have one church, and then two churches, and then three churches, maybe you can have 300 churches. And that becomes Protestantism's Achilles heel to this day, is once you say you're going to be biblical, well, who gets to determine that? And at what point does division itself become unbiblical? How much division can you have in the visible church of Jesus before you're splitting to preserve unity, or you're splitting to preserve purity, undermines the very one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one Lord and Savior of all? Constant struggle. These debates of purity and piety and orthodoxy, legitimacy of authority, the qualifications for membership, were hardly exclusive to England. Wherever there was a protest against Catholicism, which was everywhere, there was a mainstream, Lutheranism, Calvinism, Church of England, and then there was also a fringe. Those who felt that the mainstream just still hadn't gone far enough. So sure, Luther had made a break, but Luther hadn't made enough of a break. Luther and Zwingli both got that critique a lot, that they had not taken the break with Rome to its necessary and logical conclusion. For example, Luther, Zwingli, and Calvin all argued for continuing the practice of infant baptism. We'll just use that as an example. Luther, Calvin, Church of England, all retain infant baptism, and they argued that baptizing infants had biblical precedent. And they also argued that baptism of infants was warranted on theological grounds, particularly the theological idea of election, right? That it is God who chooses his people. It is not we who choose God. It is God who chooses us. And thus, baptism should be seen in very much the same light as circumcision was in the Old Testament. It was the sign and seal of God's choosing a people. It is God, so the sacrament of baptism is then God's gift to us, not our demonstration of something to God. And thus, baptizing an infant makes all the theological sense in the world. It is God's statement of welcoming this person into the community of faith. But to some, that was very problematic, in part because infant baptism had been a source of corruption in the Roman Catholic Church. Right? In Roman Catholicism, people were baptized as infants, and then taught that so long as they participated in the rituals of the church, as long as you went to Mass, as long as you said your rosary, you know, as long as you did sort of the ritual stuff, then you were saved, which is exactly how you got people who were corrupt to the core in places of leadership in Roman Catholicism. Because if you're baptized and then you just got to dot your I's and cross your T's, well, then you could be pretty morally bankrupt, but you're baptized, and you participate in the liturgy, so you must be part of the team. Maybe we should make you bishop. And thus there were radical reformers who felt that things like infant baptism needed to be stopped. In the first place, they argued that the biblical evidence for biblical baptism is very scant. You can make a case for it, but it's not obvious that the early church went around baptizing infants everywhere. But far more importantly, it seemed to them quite clear that in the New Testament, baptism is what one did after coming to believe in Jesus. That baptism was an act of confession of faith, a confession without which one is not saved. And so to baptize an infant would be at best ridiculous, and at worst, leading people astray. Right? In the best case scenario, you were just taking a dry baby, turning them into a wet baby, which usually means a cranky baby. Nobody, you know, we all understand everyone works hard to not have a cranky baby. But at worst, you're convincing people that they don't need to make any kind of personal decision of obedience to Jesus, that you've been baptized, and so as an infant, that must have covered it for you. There's nothing that you need to do as an act of personal volition to attach yourself to Jesus. And in so communicating, you might actually be condemning people to eternal condemnation. So infant baptism needs to be stopped. We need to make sure this doesn't happen in the church. And those who believe this way came to be called rebaptizers or Anabaptists, because they believe that if you'd been baptized as an infant, it didn't count. That there had been one had not been born again. And so in order for you to really have entered into the church authentically, you had to be rebaptized as an adult when you made your adult profession of belief, your profession of obedience. So only a believer's baptism was effectual in attaining eternal life. And as you can imagine, these competing views on baptism had many other ramifications as well. You disagree on those things, you're not going to just disagree on baptism. You're going to disagree on a whole bunch of stuff. If you don't believe in election, as Calvin and Zwingli and Luther did, but you believe in the necessity of personal confession of faith, you probably hold a different view on things like church membership. You probably hold a different view on who holds legitimate authority in the church. You probably hold a different opinion on the prayer book or a standard of worship and so on. And so we can add another branch to our Protestant family tree, that of the Anabaptists and later the Baptists, who are somewhat connected to they're the least radical of the radical reformers, but this is where the Baptist tradition enters into our Protestant family tree. And we could pick other aspects of the Christian life, things like passivism or the need for freedom of expression in worship, and discover other early Protestant groups that felt there were their particular issues that were essential. So within the radical reformers, you would have the Anabaptists, but you'd have Quakers as well, who have their issue isn't baptism so much as passivism. And the way that the Spirit will speak within the community of worship. Like, the Quakers are never going to have a prayer book. We're all going to sit here quietly until the Spirit moves. So you begin to have many branches of people who think that these more mainstream reformers had not gone far enough. And they begin to build all kinds of small communities all over the place for people who share their particular pet issue. They become very... I don't want to say singularly minded, but you have a whole bunch of very specialty flavors of Christianity who think that they're the real deal. This is where real Christianity happens, because we understand the one or two or three essential things that define an obedient believer. So in England, all of these groups fall under the broad heading of Puritan, but you can see that there are really many strains of Puritanism. These were the groups that were not going to compromise with a middle way. They were going to have no hints of Catholicism. They all agreed on that. Like, whether you were going to be a Baptist or a Quaker, or you all agreed you weren't going to have Roman Catholicism, and therefore you were a Puritan. They wanted no rags of popery, was their phrase, deriding the robes and vestments of Anglican priests. That they were not going to participate in a church that demonstrated the rags of popery. Needless to say, the Puritans were not amongst Elizabeth's favorite people. Right? They were messing up her perfectly crafted political and social and religious equilibrium. But things get even worse when Elizabeth dies and James I comes to the throne. James, we mentioned before, was already the king of Scotland. And there he had already had plenty of run-ins with Presbyterians. So he hated, like, he's a monarch who wants to solidify his power in Scotland, and pushing against him every step of the way are the Presbyterians, who don't believe in monarchs. So when he finally becomes king of not only Scotland, but also of England, and he runs into Presbyterians also in England, James is not a happy man. So when James takes control of England, he is determined to strengthen his grip on power, and he seeks to do this by increasing the power of the bishops in the Church of England. Right? He's not going to get Roman Catholicism back in any meaningful measure, but he can at least try to solidify that notion of monarchy by building up the power of the bishops of the Church of England. This makes the Presbyterians and the Puritans and the members of the English Parliament very upset, and they oppose the attempt. James responds by passing a bunch of anti-Puritan laws, and then eventually he just dissolves Parliament. He tries to pacify the opposition by commissioning an official English translation of the Bible. So the King James Bible is basically an attempt by King James to pacify the Presbyterians, the Puritans, and the Parliament, who are all pushing against him, and he's going to dissolve Parliament, and he's going to act all these anti-Puritan laws, but in an effort to keep to keep his head on his shoulders, he's got a compromise somewhere, so he has commissioned a new translation of the Bible into English, and thus the King James Bible is born. But he did not manage to win many friends amongst the Presbyterians or the Puritans or the House of Commons by doing this. And thus 17th century England sees a long struggle for power with the Puritans and the Presbyterians and the Parliament on one side and the Crown and the upper echelons of the Church of England on the other side. One moment the Puritans seem to have the upper hand, and suddenly there's a more Puritan flavor to the government and to the church, and then the next minute the king can reassert some power, and suddenly the Puritans are personas non grata and kind of have to go into some hiding. Back and forth it goes. And in this setting, some decide that perhaps it would simply be better to get out of England altogether. If you're a Puritan and you're watching this ebb and flow of power and oppression, the more fringe you are, the more you might decide it's time to just get out of Dodge. If you're a kind of mainstream Puritan, you're probably all right. But the more fringy you are, the more you're worried for your future. And so you begin to think, I think we'd be better somewhere else. Some will go to the European continent, and some will eventually head across the Atlantic to the New World. Remember that the 17th century is also the period of European expansion and colonization politically and economically. And England and France and Spain and the Netherlands are not content to simply compete with each other on the English continent anymore. After all, warring against each other for wealth and power on your own homeland can be terribly destructive. You know, France decides they're going to go to war with Spain over money. Well, what you're going to get is a lot of dead Spanish and French people and a lot of wrecked villages one way or the other. Why not take this conflict to some other continents and we can wreck somebody else's homeland while we compete for their... What we know is that Africa is not going to keep its gold. And the question is just whether England's going to get it or the Dutch are going to get it, but let's go fight over it there. And so expansion and colonization breaks out in the 17th century. The first English colony, as we know, is established in Jamestown, Virginia in 1607. And it was Puritan, but it was not mainly a religious community. It was far more an economic venture to try to establish a viable English colony on the eastern seaboard of the New World. For the purposes of both church and American cultural history, the far more important colonies were those established at Plymouth in 1620 and Massachusetts Bay in 1628. And I'm not sure what it says about me that to this day, the first image that pops into my mind when you say Plymouth Colony is a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving. But that is absolutely the first thing that pops into my mind, and I have to labor mightily to conjure a different picture. But I think that probably, if not a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving, at least a very two-dimensional portrait of pilgrims in black hats and buckles on their hats and on their shoes is sort of the first thing we think about when we think about the founding of America. That's the picture that we have. The Declaration of Independence actually doesn't come for another 156 years after that. But Plymouth is at least to some degree, where it all began. And it's very much worth noting, both for American church history and for American cultural history, that a major factor in our nation's birth was the arrival of a very small group of fringe Puritans who could not get along in England. Right? The group that landed at Plymouth was escaping religious oppression and seeking religious freedom, that's true, but they were being oppressed largely because they were so narrow in their interpretation of Christianity that they were unwilling to accept anything less than their interpretation of what the Bible commanded people to do. And in that sense, our founding colonists had some serious delusions of grandeur. Those first Plymouth settlers thought of themselves, truly, in a very real sense, as the new Israel. They told their own story as escaping the persecutions of Egypt in England and sojourning across the wilderness of the Atlantic to settle in the new Canaan, right, the new land flowing with milk and honey, where in very Old Testamenty terms, if they were obedient to their understanding of what God wanted, God would bless them with prosperity. And if they were disobedient, God would punish them and cleanse them from the land. And so those first settlers arrive with a very strict version of obedience that is necessary for God to bless their endeavor. But they kind of conjure themselves. Their self-image is one of the new Israel. And this is the new homeland of the true people of God. And I would venture to say that remains a little bit woven into the American psyche even today, that at some point this is the place of God's greatest affection, where people who really understand what the Bible is all about are here. We worship in spirit. This is where we worship in spirit and in truth, is in American Christianity. So those first settlers' desires for religious freedom were in one sense quite noble, but we also have to understand that they were a people quite unwilling to tolerate what many of us would consider reasonable compromise, and that certainly sets a tone for future Christianity in America. The Massachusetts Bay Colony was founded by Puritans as well, but Puritans less radical than those at Plymouth. They were still quite serious. But whereas the Plymouth colonists had departed entirely from the church in England, the settlers in Massachusetts Bay were still members of the Anglican Communion. They wanted a good bit of self-determination in religious matters, but they did not make a total break with the Church of England. And it's through them that the Church of England comes to the West, or the New World, and how the Book of Common Prayer arrives in the American colonies. But of course, it wasn't only Puritans who came to the New World. Maryland was founded by British Catholics who were also feeling religious persecution in England. So it wasn't just Puritans who felt as though they needed religious freedom. There were Catholics in England who hired boats came to Maryland. William Penn's response to the oppression of the Quakers, of which he was a member, was to found Pennsylvania as a place of complete religious freedom, where you could worship in any way that you wanted, including no way at all. New York was originally, of course, New Amsterdam. It was founded by the Dutch in 1624, who brought with them the Dutch Reformed Church and all of its strict Calvinist understandings. Calvinist theology came to the New World very early on, but Presbyterians were actually not a major force at the beginning, in part because we were having a fair bit of power through Parliament. I mean, it wasn't as tough to be a Presbyterian in the 17th century as it was to be some of the more radical reformers. The first presbytery wasn't formed until 1709 and was located in Philadelphia, and probably not a surprise that Presbyterians would first be drawn to Pennsylvania, where there was a tremendous religious freedom. Once the Presbyterians arrive, however, we become a dominant force in American culture, particularly because of our form of government. Because Presbyterianism acknowledges the need for hierarchy, but it grants office not to individuals, but to groups. Right? Many of the Puritans were congregationalists, which means they saw each individual congregation as its own self-contained thing. No higher authority. Those who belonged to the Church of England were still governed by bishops, bishops that came to the American colonies. So the more radical reformers had really no church authority at all, or a very limited congregational authority. But it became very clear that the colonists were not going to go in for a government built around bishops and monarchs again. So as the colonies begin to grow, and they need some measure of connection to each other, I mean, they need a structure. What structure are they going to look to? Congregationalism isn't going to work once you get bigger than a village. You want to have a bishop or a monarch? And suddenly Presbyterianism and that form of organizing authority becomes tremendously persuasive in the American colonies. That, along with the education that was required of Presbyterian clergy. Right? Presbyterian clergy have always been expected. I mean, it's been required that Presbyterian clergy be very well educated. And so the combination of political structuring and of intellectual ability gives a lot of Presbyterians a lot of authority as the colonies are growing into their second, third, fourth generations. Next week, as we move into the 18th century, we're going to take up the question of what happens in the second and third and fourth generations in the American church. It's one thing for you to move to the New World because of your passion for religious freedom, to participate in your kind of fringe, strict, austere movement. Does that mean your children agree with you? Right? How many first-generation immigrants come over preserving the native way, the native traditions, the native language, the native culture, and how many of their children decide they like Nike and Diet Coke and American football and the tensions that that creates within the family as we wanted you to identify with this particular group, and suddenly your children are not invested like you were in all these institutions that you labored so mightily to create. So what happens in a society so rooted in religion when religious fervor inevitably wanes? That might cause a crisis within the church. And it's to that crisis of the 18th century that we turn next week.